Hey everyone, welcome to episode 54 of the Historic Performance Podcast featuring Jonas Dodu, head coach at Speedworks. Many of you may know Jonas as a sprint and speed coach, and you wouldn't be wrong. He's worked with plenty of top sprinters in the UK, and he also does some consultant work with team sport athletes, mainly in the realm of rugby, soccer, and netball. One thing that I actually learned in talking with Jonas is that many of the cases that he gets with team sport athletes is actually revolving around rehabilitation and return to performance. So many teams, when they can't figure out why an athlete is consistently getting injured while running, may come to Jonas and ask for his opinion and for his coaching eye. So Jonas talks to us about his rehabilitation process, the way he goes about doing return to performance, and of course his coaching philosophy, which is athlete-centered and coach-led. A lot of great information here. I think many of you are going to enjoy it. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, I'm finally glad to be joined by Jonas Tawia Dodu. Jonas, thanks for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me.
Jonas, to start us off, could you tell us a little bit about your career journey and how then it ended up with the creation of Speedworks?
Yeah, for sure. My journey started from being a rugby S&C coach. Well, in fact, being a rugby player, being constantly injured, but that being quite interesting because through that injury pathway and that rehab pathway, I came across different practitioners, therapists, podiatrists, people with different mindsets, different philosophies towards and processes towards fixing me as an individual. And although none of them was able to, you know, get me to where I thought I should be, I learned a lot about that, you know, there's many ways to roam and there's many different thought processes behind injury and rehab. So that really interested me. I did a strength and conditioning course. I did a degree in coaching and conditioning and a master's. And throughout that process, I was always coaching from my first year in uni. So by the time I had finished my master's, I had coached rugby football, equine, you know, I'd done PT, I'd done rehab, I'd spent a lot of time already developing some of my craft knowledge and practical skills. During that process, I found Dan Path. I did my master's thesis on Dan Path and I studied him and became one of, you know, hundreds of coaches that looked up to him as a mentor and was lucky enough to be employed by UK Athletics as an apprentice coach under him in the build up to 2012. And that was a great opportunity for myself and a number of other individuals. After the Olympics, we founded Speedworks and essentially Speedworks is a service for developing athletes. And it's meant to plug that gap between really good junior and international. And so we have over 20 athletes based at Lee Valley and we service them with sports science and sports therapy and coaching and mentoring and the aim is to find young talent, support them with everything they need and take them to the top really. And you know, not everyone is going to become an Olympic medalist or even go to an Olympic Games, but I think that process of development and learning about your body and about how to manage yourself and life is an important process for everyone to go through. So Speedworks services athletes, we have on-site athletes, we have a number of visiting athletes from across the globe, mostly from Europe, and we also do a coach education service called Speedwise, and we work with team sports players, majority rugby, football, netball, in a service we call Speed Skills. So Speedworks is kind of a bit of a diverse service at the moment, and we're really enjoying the different types of athletes and people that we come across on a weekly basis.
I think a good starting point for the podcast would be to discuss your coaching philosophy. And I know the kind of phrase that you have is athlete-centered, coach-led.
Yeah.
So could you just explain to us a little bit about your philosophy and what were some of the cornerstones that led you down the path to having this philosophy?
The cornerstone. So I almost did a PhD in coaching. And the reason why I didn't do the PhD was because I felt that having, you know, finishing a PhD and being Dr. Dodu sounded great, but actually I would have been a bit of a fraud being able to say, I'm a doctor. I am an expert in athletics coaching, but I hadn't actually coached someone to get to that level. But you know, either way, I was always interested in understanding the deeper components of learning, development, motor learning and education and even personal education, reflection. I was always really interested in understanding those components. So I spent a lot of time, my own interest, reading a lot and trying to understand a lot. And I realized that actually, and during my apprenticeship, I got to spend a lot of time with different coaches, very, very successful coaches. Coaches that focused on energy system development, and that was their focus, or strength and conditioning and plyometrics, or technical development and actually finding a minimum effective dose. And people, you know, you watch the Olympic Games and there's eight people in that final, and many of them have come from different ways of coaching and different ways of training. So very, very early on in my career, I realized there was many roads to Rome. There were many ways to coach different athletes. And you look at some of the most successful athlete coaches, and they've coached a particular type of athlete again and again, generation after generation. Different athletes, but normally one type of athlete suited that coach, or a few types of athlete suited that coach's philosophy. It could be suited that coach's philosophy, suited that coach's character. It could be a variety of things, but either way, I was quite clear that there are different ways of coaching, and there was no one dogma. There was no one way of doing things. And so then my question was then, which way do you choose with which athlete? And that's a hard thing to decide. You know, there are plenty of tests and there are plenty of ways of evaluating people's strengths and weaknesses. But essentially the easiest and quickest way is to just get a response from the athlete, get a reflection from the athlete, get an understanding, build a relationship with that athlete and get an understanding of what has worked, what they like, what they dislike, why they dislike it. Is it because it doesn't work or is it because it's difficult? How long does it take for them to get tired within a session, within a microcycle, within a macro? How long do they recover? How long does it take for them to recover? The small things that make sense, you know, what kind of feedback worked well for them? What sessions do they prefer? It's just understanding the athlete and educating the athlete to make a rational reflection of training and the training process, I think is critical to me, because then it allows me to figure out what should I make more of an emphasis on, what training component, what type of exercise, what type of feedback, what type of microcycle design, what kind of loading strategy, all of those decisions that we think we come up with, and we think we come up with a master plan. I think it's the opposite. I think the athletes point us towards what works. And it takes experimentation and it takes a sound. You have a brand new athlete and you can't straight away ask them, what do you want to do? I think it takes time of exposing them to a rational training plan that has variety and step progression and enough time for stability in motor learning and enough time to understand that athlete and develop some of the basic motor skills you want to develop for your sport or your activity. Very, very quickly in that process, I think it's important to start to have a deeper understanding of what you're actually doing and what effect it's having on that athlete. So that's why, you know, that's where we come from, this athlete-centered, coach-led process.
As part of Speed Works, you mentioned that there's different subsets because you're working with a variety of athletes. I believe you said Speed Skill is the one that involves team sport athletes, mainly rugby, football, and netball.
Yep.
As part of that process, when it comes to speed and team sports, and you have a player coming to you and is looking to improve in that facet, how do you go about assessing them and evaluating their current needs?
It happens at different levels. It happens at levels that are quantitative and as well as qualitative and objective as well as subjective. And it all depends on the amount of time we're expected to have that athlete or the amount of time I'm with a team. So a better example is when you go in to visit a team, the coaches typically at most teams will have their own metrics that they decide are important for testing and monitoring. That will kind of give you some guidance as towards what you think is missing and where you would focus on more than others. My point is that if you look across a scale of specificity from acceleration, maximum velocity and change of direction being your most specific type activity, all the way down to lifting weights and maximal strength and maximal isometric qualities, you know, there are a number of different ways of assessing a group of individuals. And to me, it's more important to maybe add to what's missing, what on that spectrum is missing. Now, most people these days are in the gym and are doing some kind of isometric dynamometry or doing some kind of jump profiling, or using, you know, weighted jump profiling and coming up with some kind of false velocity curve, or it being just doing isometric pulls, isometric squats, you know, whatever it is that they decide they want to do. Most people are finding ways of doing that. And some of my colleagues really focus more around doing some kind of jump profiling, doing some kind of single leg drop jump profiling. So some kind of loaded jump profiling, sorry. And then some kind of single leg jump profiling. And that's kind of where their biggest focus is. And then when we move towards specificity, that jump profiling that's vertical in nature, I think it's pretty important to start to look at what they can do in a horizontal plane. And I'm pretty old school. You know, I would take them to a pit and say, okay, let's look at standing long jump, standing triple jump. If you're not good at doing single leg plyometric activities, that already tells us something, especially as a team sport player. But okay, let's do a double leg bunny three times into a pit. And these are really easy, simple metrics that don't just give you numbers. You know, someone who can do a standing long jump, 3:20, you know, as a team sport player, that's pretty decent. But if they can do that, and actually most of their action and the preparatory action and most of the movement pattern is in a vertical plane, then you can already see, even though you see that good number of 3:20, you probably realize they could probably jump 3:40, for example, or 3:30, but the movement pattern is limiting them. So that same kind of concept, you move across to the more elastic activities like a standing triple or three hops into a pit or three bunnies or whatever it is that you choose that you think is the most important activity. And again, you can take some numbers away from that and compare that against the average of the group or against some baseline data that you've got. But I'm often more interested in the movement. How have they achieved that? Have they done it by landing with a very plantar flexed foot, completely jamming their knees into the ground, rolling their knee, and most of that action coming from the knee joint and quadricep? Or have they been able to land with a more heel to toe action, being able to stabilize the lower leg, the shin, being able to stabilize the knee and project using their hip? That to me is a much more effective and efficient movement pattern, and it tells me a lot more about that person's abilities. And again, you just move up the spectrum. You know, what are they like when they're resisted? What are they like accelerating from zero, from with no movement? What are they like accelerating with momentum? What's their movement patterns like when it comes to acceleration? Do they know how to transition into max V? Even team sport players, you know, I think after Leicester City's done what they've done, you have a lot of more teams saying they're doing speed work and saying it for different reasons. But the question is, and a lot of people have actually said, max velocity isn't needed in game sports, but we know that the movement pattern is required. And actually, if you're doing a strength and conditioning program, running upright, be it at max speed or just sub max, is the most important way to load eccentric and isometrically the posterior chain and Achilles. So the question is, what are people doing? What are they doing in their own metrics? How are they measuring their own team? And what area can I add
that can give them some more data or just more understanding of the data they're collecting. So, for example, I had two players visit us last week with the national S&C coach. And in all my queuing, I like to be, you know, you watch someone do drills. So you ask me what, you know, how do you assess? You can automatically see someone doing any kind of drill, and you can start to see, is this person, would this person rather spend a bit more time on the ground, not switch their limbs as symmetrically, spend more time on the ground, amortize a bit more in order to produce the force and project themselves? Or is this person switching their limbs quite effectively, spending minimal time on the ground? That's their choice of movement pattern. And I happen to have two individuals, two international rugby players, who have very, very different profiles in terms of how they move, but are both quite a similar speed, in fact. And so my cueing is very, very clear, or my conversation with the S&C coach was very clear that this person clearly is not very reactive, isn't very good at preparing their ankle and foot for the ground, isn't very good at creating pre-tension through their system and being ready for the ground. And this person's clearly opposite. And his feedback was, well, actually, that's quite interesting, because that's what we see in our analysis. That's what we've seen in our testing. So we think these two people should get two different strength and conditioning programs. So I think I've answered your question in a roundabout way. I feel most people are doing most things that are really important for gathering data and gathering a deeper understanding. So rather than me just rolling in and saying, this is what I think is the holy grail, I'd rather just add some substance and add some often more subjective information that helps them stick the numbers together and make the numbers real.
Typically, when a team approaches you in order for you to work with them, do they have specific questions in mind that they're looking to solve?
Yeah, they've always got specific questions in mind. And to be fair, I'm typically approached more for rehab than I am for speed, and more for end stage rehab, post-surgery, post-repetitive hamstring injury is a typical one. And normally the question is, or normally the scenario is, we are unsure why this person keeps re-injuring their hamstrings beyond the fact that we see this person moving what we think is improper. But all of their numbers in the gym are better than when they were previously, prior to injury. All of the things we're doing, we think they are above the average standard, but yet they're still being re-injured, or they still feel like they're not ready. That's normally the case. We think we're seeing things that are improper, but we need an expert eye. So often I'm there for coaching eye. I'm there to kind of give them some clarity as to maybe sometimes they're seeing it already, but they're not sure what or why or how to fix it.
Jonas, when it comes to the rehabilitation process, you mentioned that teams are reaching out to you with specific individuals that have had chronic injuries. And prior to the podcast, we were talking a little bit about your three main concepts or fundamental concepts. So could you tell us a little bit about the three fundamental concepts and then how that relates to the way you deal with a player during the rehabilitation process?
So my three concepts, you know, they really come from me not being very, very smart and wanting to summarize what I've learned from different coaches of from different sports and also from the biomechs and what they're really saying in their kinetics and kinematics. And I wanted to be able to summarize it in a way that I could constantly recall on without having to talk in science talk. So the three concepts that I really talk about are orientation of your force, which should result in the projection of your center of mass. And the second concept essentially is the switching of your limbs. And if you switch your limbs effectively, I know Franz Bosch and his has talked a lot about this cross extension or cross flexion reflex. Really effective switching of your limbs can enhance, firstly, can enhance pretension in the posterior chain and in the whole system, really. So that can again means that you hit the ground harder. And then the last area would be reactivity. So can you orientate your force? Can you switch your limbs, and can you be reactive? And And I think if you can address those three components in a linear and in a lateral, in a general and in a more specific way, then you typically get someone who's fit, fast, explosive, and efficient.
So let's say that a team approaches you, they give you an athlete that's chronically had hamstring issues, and your goal is mainly to gradually progress them up to the point that they feel confident, the player feels confident, and the staff also feels that the player can be reintegrated into full chaotic training. How does that process come along in terms of rehabilitation? Kind of where's your starting point and how do you try to get to your end point?
My starting point is always going to be the basic stuff. So I'll make a disclaimer. I don't think I'm doing anything that's very different from most speed movement development coaches. And I think all that's different is what I see and how I cue it and what I expect from people. So my start point, okay, if someone walks in and it's the first session and I'm not sure where they're at, I'd probably start with walking and I'd watch them walk. And I'd probably walk alongside them and I'd get an understanding of their rhythm. You know, do they heel strike? And do they heel strike with a bit of a inverted foot, pronate, and then toe off of all five toes? Or, you know, when they do that, does that action result in a reflexive type of hip flexion? And do their hips oscillate and undulate? And you know, do their shoulders move in an opposite but a similar rhythm to their hips? And that's the first thing I'm looking at, is just rhythm and posture and timing. And once I see that and get a grip of how they're doing that, I would ask them to do an A walk, which is just like an A skip, you know, Gerald Mack A skip, but it's just literally walking, rolling through heel to toe and driving the knee up. And I'm now taking up a better look at their posture and their trunk and timing again. And then we gradually move through that kind of process from A skip to B skip to straight leg scissors and a variety of other low level reactive drills. And as they increase in complexity, I'm starting to see, would these people rather keep the hip rather level or low and spend a bit more time on the ground and have big pushes off behind them, which results in a bit more lumbar extension? Or are these people that would rather actually land and in that kind of person, maybe they have a bit of a bent knee and it's quite a quaddy action, maybe quite loud? Or is this someone that would rather land with a straight leg, quite under their center of gravity? Do they spend minimal time on the ground? Do they, you know, does the knee and foot only travel a few, you know, 10 or 20 centimeters behind the hip? Do they keep the posture more upright or lean back? And I'm starting to get a better understanding of this person, their strengths, their weaknesses. And that's just generally just figuring out if they're more concentric or elastic at that moment in time. But then the bigger question for an injured athlete is, okay, well, what's happening left versus right? Are they choosing to be opposite left and right? You know, is one leg deciding to be more elastic and reactive and the other leg deciding to push more? And we would maybe, it's counterintuitive, but sometimes the leg that's deciding to be a bit more reactive on the ground is the injured leg, because that's the leg that doesn't want to produce big forces. That's the leg that doesn't want to go through its whole contraction range. Or sometimes it's vice versa. So that's really important to see. And you know, some injuries aren't injuries because a limb is injured, but it's because it's overworked. So I'm starting to ask these questions, you know, what are the movement differences? Why are they moving differently? Can I cue it right now to change? Is the athlete aware of the differences? Are those differences going up and down the chain and creating bigger problems on other limbs or other segments of their spine or of the body? So I'm constantly asking myself these questions, and often there's a physio there at the same time. And through my cueing and my inquiry and when things are changing or not changing, the physio can normally reflect, not normally when the athlete's there, or sometimes when the athlete's there, they will talk about how this relates to their ability to do X exercise in the gym or a certain movement that they've been doing elsewhere. Often the exercises and movements I'm doing are exercises that most people think are needed for movement re-education. We do a range of different dribbles, which are just basically ankling exercises that range in from being quite small swinging moments of the leg to bigger and bigger moments, to it looks kind of like sprinting.
you know, progressive running is clearly something that is important in people's rehab. So most activities the guys are used to, but maybe haven't done the same way, are used to, but maybe haven't been cued or coached the same way. And so haven't always had the same result. You know, that kind of reflection from the coach, from the physio, from the athlete is pretty important. And so, you know, I've gone through a range of drills. I've gone through a range of different running at different speeds. Depends what injury or what I can or cannot progress to. I'll do a range of very low level plyometrics, starting with a range of hop and sticks in straight and sideways, lateral, backwards. We have a number of different jump circuits that I'll normally finish a session with, normally on a different surface, be it, you know, if they've come to the track, it will be on the mat or in the sand. If we're at the club, you know, we may do it on grass if we've been on the Astro or on a mat. And that circuit is there's a range of different circuits, and it's not the circuit that's important. It's the fact that there is a number of contacts happening in a variety of different ways that the athlete has to be is kept guessing and kept adapting, and is just a great way to develop some lower leg stiffness, lower leg conditioning, as well as some more bigger movements that are more directed at the hip, directed at stabilizing the hip with a variety of different forces and vectors challenging the body. So yeah, I guess that's the process. I'll take them through a variety of different drills, from moving at 0.5 meters per second all the way up to about 4 or 5 meters per second. You know, if they are able and if it's appropriate on that day, we'll take them through a variety of dribbles and runs. That will take them to probably 7 or 8 meters per second. And then we'll take them through a variety of jumping activities. You know, that's the base level. That's session one or session, you know, session two or three, depending on where the athlete's coming from.
So a couple of follow-up questions on that. The first one is going to be about cueing. At the onset of the podcast, you were talking about how part of what you like to do as a coach is really understand your athlete and find the best way that you can communicate with them.
Hmm.
So when it comes to figuring out what type of cues work with certain athletes, is it just that you do it based on observation? So you give them some cues that you're used to and see how they react to it and then modify it based on that? Or do you try to get a sense of how does this athlete learn, or so how is that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest thing is to throw a number of cues at people and see what makes sense and see what doesn't. You sometimes can see what makes sense before they even try it, just by saying a certain thing to an individual. You know, they may nod and aha, or frown and say, what does that mean? You know, the best case scenario with guys that you develop a relationship with is you take the cue from them. You make changes, because not every day that is a verbal cue. It might be a physical cue. I might demonstrate. I might show them video. I might give them an activity that over exaggerates the movement, the change I want to make, and their feedback would be, oh, that made me feel like X, or okay, I understand. I need to do Y. One of my girls, her new cue, which we all love because it's pretty funny, is in reference to acceleration, and she's a sprinter, and in reference to having a really really projecting yourself forwards and having minimal vertical leakage, her cue is to lead with her skull. And another cue she came up with was to run with both knees. So sometimes cues mean nothing to a coach, but they mean everything to an athlete. And that cue works for her. It allows her to make sense of what her plan is to do, but also to go into flow state and apply it without having to, without too much, I guess, baggage to be thinking about. So yeah, I think it's a variety of ways of finding it. And, you know, through experience, I've figured out when you see a certain issue with a certain person, it kind of tells you their strengths and their weaknesses. And it kind of points me towards a certain cue that would probably 80% of the time work with that individual. But cues are transient, and sometimes certain cues work with individuals. And as they progress, get stronger, get more aware, work on different components, certain cues don't work as well anymore.
and you have to keep moving with that athlete. So, you know, some people ask me what are my most favorite cues, and really I'm simple. Acceleration, my cue is about going forwards. Just go forwards. We talk about going forwards a lot, and max velocity is about bouncing, and max velocity is really about bouncing forwards, and speed maintenance is about bouncing up, and that's really where we start from. We really simplify it to that level, and then through practice and experimentation we start to find more discrete cues to help that individual at that particular time during that particular session with that particular goal, whatever particular goal we have at that time. But essentially the summary for everybody should be to go forwards or to bounce forwards.
The other follow-up question that I have is actually about dribbling or dribbles.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess that the reason that you like to use dribbles is because, as you mentioned, it helps an athlete get into kind of this relaxed rhythmic state and kind of a low amplitude setting. Are there certain advantages, for example, using dribbles with athletes that are not in a rehab process in order, if you see specific inefficiencies in their running mechanics?
Yeah, definitely. So let's go back to my key cues or my key components of sprinting and change direction. About orientating your force and switching and being reactive, those three things are critical components of all movement. But I think dribbling, really, non-injured athletes for sure. I think a number of different components and skills can be developed with dribbling, and essentially being able to orientate your force forwards, but spend minimal time on the ground, and to switch your limbs effectively so that you can create enough force in that small amount of time is really important. And dribbling forces you to be able to do that. And if you don't switch your limbs effectively, and if you're not reactive on the ground, you won't be able to go forwards and recycle your legs ready enough to do it again. So I think dribbling at different heights is a great way of actually just creating that pretension, playing around with pretension and reactivity without exposing. So basically a dribble, a high knee dribble, is very, very close to being a very effective, biomechanically correct or biomechanically efficient sprint. So many people, we spend a lot of time doing high knee dribbles, and then we start doing what we would call sprinting, and they will say, actually, that just looks like a good dribble. And so it's a nice way of piecing the two together without exposing them to 10 meters per second. It's a nice way to, in the winter or in your off season or your preseason, where maybe fitness and other things are a goal, where you can work on technical and motor learning and you know, eliminating slack in the system and pretension, all those key things that once the season comes and once the competitive component of your season is more important, all those things that you know you're going to need and want later on, okay, you can work on them now. You can work on them now with minimal taxation of the body, and maybe you work on them during a fitness session. You know, I think long are gone the sessions where you're running 4 miles or 10 mile runs. You know, most people are doing some kind of short-sighted game or doing some kind of repeated sprint. Why not dribble? Why not play around with repeated accelerations or repeated drills? And you know, we get fit a variety of ways, and dribbling is definitely preferred rather than that death march, backside mechanics, massive lordosis type run that you see when people are fatigued and can't hold postures.
At the end of the day, when it comes to a team sport athlete and they're finally coming to the end stage rehab, they're looking to go back into an environment that's obviously chaotic. There's going to be decision making for rugby and football is going to be a lot of change of direction. And you've mentioned during your rehabilitation process that you like to take them from the basics and then finally at the end start adding in a little bit of the chaotic environment and decision-making, change of the direction. What are the key factors that you're looking for when you're looking to make that change? How do you analyze whether an athlete is ready to start integrating to a chaotic environment where there is going to be change of direction?
So the real truth behind that is sometimes it's not my choice. Often, when I think an athlete is two-thirds of the way there, a team will say they are ready. And that's just the reality of professional sport. When an athlete is injury-free and back to old speed, or typically, in my experience, they come back faster, then they're ready to go. But also in my experience, when you make a rehab athlete faster and send them straight back into maybe under 21 type games or straight back into the first team, their accuracy of change of direction, the accuracy of skill of shooting or of passing or of receiving a pass is off, because you suddenly send someone who's used to running at X speed and they're now a meter per second faster, or half a meter per second faster. And so their judgment is off. But I think that's the reality of professional sport. And it's just something that really good physios and coaches who will carry on along the journey with that athlete will, where possible, try to ease them in if the coach allows it. But essentially, you know, you get an athlete, they come, they can't do a walking drill, they can't do dribbles because there's a bit of imbalance or inhibition, and that's typically the biggest deal, is there's inhibition in a single leg hop, lateral or forwards, inhibition in late phase swing. So you know, if the knee blocks at the top after it's the legs recovered, you'll see some people, if it's a hamstring, the timing of that knee block, the lower leg swinging out and coming back down to the ground, is a big thing that's off. The timing of that ankle or that foot to fire and hit the ground is off, and the projection of their hip is off. It's wrong. It's different. It's the timing is wrong, or it's just inhibited. It just doesn't even come on. So my first phase is, okay, figure out where's the inhibition and address it. Address it with cueing, address it with opportunity to self-organize and figure it out for themselves with a number of activities. Once they've addressed that inhibition at a low level, it's about taking them through the phases of intensity, be it running intensity or plyometric intensity, and give them opportunity to use that first type of cue or fix they did at lower intensities and apply it at higher intensities. As you get to those higher intensities, you may find that the injury, the original injury, isn't the limiting factor anymore. Because when you get into those higher intensities, typically you've got rid of that low level inhibition and some of the other weak links that maybe predispose that person to injury is starting to now wave its head at you. And in those scenarios, then, okay, yeah, we're starting to address, you know, you may, you talked about assessment. So you may video someone do a 10 meter sprint and, you put out cones, or you've got up to jump, or you've got some way of analyzing step frequency and step length, and you start to see that their dominance is towards one or another. And you make some adjustments. You maybe design a few sessions to address that inability to grow the rhythm, or to gradually reduce the stride length, the stride frequency, ground contact time, or gradually raise their hip and transition their hips. You give them some solutions to doing that. And then when you start to add some low-level cutting, be it cutting at 45 degrees or 90 degrees, be it change of direction fully, like 505 type, you know, run, stop, turn around, go, and you start to give them the ability, or you start to use what you've used in the past to address inhibitions or low preactivity or low reactivity or whatever it is, you typically use the same solution and you apply it to that scenario. So now they can change direction more effectively. They know how to, you know, when it's change of direction, we're no longer just talking about those, talking about the legs being the biggest deal. You know, for change of direction, quite clearly orientation of your torso and rotation of your torso, and the placement of your foot is a big deal to maximizing that ability to create pretension and to be reactive in that change of direction. You know, I say reactive, clearly change of direction, your ground contact time is going to be a lot higher than acceleration or max V, but you still want it to be, you're still trying to minimize it.
given them that opportunity to learn and understand what's going on there, and your knee injured guys or your ankle injured guys, typically that's a big deal as well. That's probably perhaps a bigger deal than just the linear stuff. And when you start to see the changes you expect to see, when you start to see a balance between the two, a competency to do those, you know, those three different types of change of direction task, be it moving in a linear fashion, stop and turn and go again, be it 45 degrees or 90 degrees cut or some kind of swerve. When you see a competency to do those tasks at low levels, again, it's the same deal. You then increase the intensity, and the intensity is typically the speed of incoming, how fast they're coming in to do that task. Now, once they're competent at doing that, you add a ball. I mean, we've probably added a ball way before that, but essentially you add a bit more complexity. You add some very simple decision-making. You add more complex decision-making. You add a partner. You know, that's the process that I would go through. And then I think from that point onwards, you've got someone who is running fast, who is reactive, who is moving well, who is making decisions, then they're making decisions that require a lot of processing, so the right decisions, and then also performing the task. And then from that point onwards, I think it's pretty important, and maybe before that point, it's pretty important to know what the coach, not the SSC coach, but the skills coach, defense coach, attack coach, forwards coach, backs coach, it's important to know what they want, because that process, that last or that third or fourth process is important to incorporate the types of decisions that they will be making when they go into that real chaotic environment. And that's where a lot of collaboration needs to happen. But like I say, by that point, often athletes are faster, feel good, are explosive, and they're taken back into the general population. And then it's sometimes a bit of luck of the draw. Some guys are really good. Some teams are really good at gradually putting people back in and giving them a lot of feedback, and be it visual via video or coaching during the session. And some teams, because of the skill level of that player, just expect that player to just fall in and get into it. And you know, great players, you know, in Premiership football and rugby are great not only because they are fast and explosive, which I can help them with, but generally they're gifted anyway. I don't make someone fast. I just help them become faster. Great players aren't picked purely because of that. Usually they're great decision makers, and the speed of decision making and being able to read the game that really makes them so expensive to buy. So often that gift of being able to make really good decisions sometimes is a problem, because they can get away with not being ready yet because they can read the game quicker than most other people. So I think that's the gray line where it's really important to have collaboration between S&C or sprints or rehab coach and skills coach.
Jonas, since we're at the tail end of the podcast right now, and I usually finish all my podcasts by having the guests give recommendations to university students that are exploring exercise science or strength and conditioning, sports science, and looking to make a career out of it. What recommendations would you have for them?
I would recommend that they coach as many different people, as many different skill levels as possible, and they read everything out there and speak to as many experienced coaches as possible. And in that process, try and look for common denominators. Find out what makes, you know, if they've got the 10 best coaches on their list, what makes them great, and what's common across all 10 of them, or at least the majority of them, and what things can they copy as development coaches now, and what things actually are just going to take time and take coaching hours, time in the trenches to learn, and be clear on the difference between the two. Having a base skeleton to your philosophy, heuristics and rules of thumb to your philosophy, are things that coaches can develop as soon as, you know, as soon as they decide that they want to be coaches, as long as you spend enough time around great coaches. But being able to make quick decisions and being able to read your environment and develop a coaching eye is something that only time and experience and reflection in action and after action can do.
Jonas, if anyone wants to reach out to you, if they have any questions or comments regarding anything you said on the podcast, what's the best way they can do so?
So most people contact me through Twitter, eatsleeptrain_. But it's probably quicker and simpler to email me through jonas@speedworks.training. And our website is www.speedworks.training. So we have a number of CPD opportunities happening over the summer with some really good guest speakers turning up. Then that will be advertised over the next couple of weeks. And yeah, so I'm pretty easygoing. My wife's really the boss, so she's normally the one who pushes me to make sure I get back to emails and make sure that I'm spreading the good word. So yeah.
Jonas, thanks for taking the time today, and I'm glad that we could finally find the time that worked for the two of us to get you on. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. I appreciate being amongst a number of really, really good speakers and coaches and practitioners that you have on your podcast. So thanks for making the time for me also.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to head over to iTunes to leave a review and rating. It really helps others discover the show. Next week, podcast guest is going to be Dr. John Bartlett. He's going to be talking about sleep research, as well as give some practical insight into ways that you can monitor and then create interventions with athletes that have trouble sleeping. It's some really great information. So I'll see you guys next week.